My talk today will be about relational observables and cosmological perturbation theory, and is about work I've done together with Bianca Dittrich from Perimeter Institute. And most of the things I will talk about today were published in the two papers I've given in the reference. Next slide, please. The plan of the talk is the following. After giving a short motivation why I think that it's useful to do cosmological perturbation theory using relational observables, I will give an introduction to the topic of relational observables. First, I want to review the general idea and the framework, which is basically Carlo Rovelli.
I'm sorry to interrupt. This is Marseille. The sound is very bad here. I don't know elsewhere. We barely, the volume is very low.
Is that a general problem?
The sound is very good in Lisbon.
Okay, shall I go on, just or?
Yeah, just try to speak loud, okay?
Okay, so first I want to give the general idea of relational observables and to review the framework, which was introduced by Carlo Rovelli in the 90s and then generalized by Bianca Dittrich some years ago. And then I want to talk about a perturbative framework, which can be used to do perturbations around symmetry-reduced factors of the phase space. I want to talk about cosmological perturbation theory. First, I want to review the standard approach of cosmological perturbation theory due to Brandenberger, Feldman, and Mukhanov, which works perfectly well through linear order, but there are certain problems when one tries to generalize the framework to higher orders. And then I want to talk about using the relational framework, relational observables perturbed around homogeneous and isotropic sectors of the phase space. And I want to show you how one can overcome some of the problems of the standard approach. I will illustrate how this works using an example, the Bianchi 1 cosmological model. Next slide, please. So you might wonder why I think that one should do cosmological perturbation theory using relational observables. And I think the reason is that general relativity is a background in event theory. And as we'll see, one can formulate gauge invariant dynamics in the language of relational observables. And so it is quite natural to use relational observables in cosmology as well when one sees cosmology as the sub-area of general relativity that deals with homogeneous and isotropic solutions. As you will see, that using these relational observables in cosmological perturbation theory has several advantages compared to the standard approach, namely because we start from gauge invariant observables of the full theory, and the issue of gauge invariant and spectrum independence can be controlled much better, and because this is a relational framework, the interpretation of the results is straightforward. As you will see, we can reproduce the standard results of the linearized theory, but what is much more important is that, at least to my knowledge, that is the first cosmological perturbation theory that works to arbitrary order. And so we can consistently ask the question of back reaction effects. Next slide, please. So the heuristic idea of relational observable is the following. Classical general relativity is a gauge theory where the gauge group is the four-dimensional diffeomorphism group. In other words, general relativity is a theory that is formulated on a differentiable manifold, but not on a metric one. So by construction, fields on this manifold are not observables themselves, even in the classical theory. Whenever we think of observables, we think of relations between dynamical fields. For instance, we could relate the scalar field or any other metafield of the theory to the gravitational field of the theory. And the idea of relational observables or complete observables is to make this idea rigorous. Next slide, please. One can think about the question of observables very nice in the Hamiltonian framework, and if gauge theory formulated in the Hamiltonian language has the following structure. There is a phase space with a symplectic structure given by the Poisson bracket on this phase space, where Qi and the momenta Pj are canonically conjugate variables on that phase space. Furthermore, there are constraints in the theory, and these constraints not only restrict to the accessible part of the phase space, but also if these constraints form a first-class constraint algebra, they generate gauge transformations. And these gauge orbits can be written down using the notion of the phase space flow alpha. And the situation is the following. All points on the gauge orbit are mathematically different, but can physically not be distinguished. So this leads to the requirement that all observables, that means quantities which can in principle be measured, must be constant along these gauge orbits. Formulated in Hamiltonian language, this leads to the definition of a Dirac observable, and every phase space function O is a Dirac observable if it has weakly vanishing Poisson brackets with all the constraints, where weakly means that this equality holds at least on the constrained hypersurface. Next slide, please. So now I want to talk about the idea of complete observables, which was introduced by Rovelli in the 90s. And I want to illustrate how this works using an easy example, namely the reparametrized free particle in one spatial dimension, where the phase space is four-dimensional. There's the spatial coordinate x and the time coordinate clock function t, and their momenta. And then there is a Hamiltonian constraint, which generates the dynamic of the theory. T or x are not observables of the theory that can be proven by just taking the Poisson brackets of t or x with a constraint, and it is not vanishing. Physically, this can be interpreted as follows. The theory does not make predictions for the position of the particle or the time of the particle, but for a combination of these two. The theory makes predictions for the position of the particle at some time. Made rigorous, this idea is the following. We can construct a Dirac observable in the following way. Take the complete observable capital F associated to the phase space function x and the clock function t and a certain parameter tau. It's just the value of x at that point on the gauge orbit where the clock function t takes the value tau. And as you can see at the right-hand side of this formula, the complete observables, they encode the dynamics of the system. By just taking the Poisson bracket of the complete observable with a constraint, one can prove that capital F is indeed Dirac observable. And furthermore, as I told you, it has a relational interpretation because the complete observable gives the value of x at that point on the gauge orbit, where the clock function t takes the value tau. Next slide, please. These ideas were generalized for field theories some years ago by Bianca Dittrich, and the setup is basically the same, but the phase space is infinite dimensional in this case. So we start with an infinite dimensional phase space. Again, it has a symplectic structure and canonically conjugate variables q and p. And there is a first-class constraint algebra, again. Now the construction for complete observables in field theories is the following. There is a set of constraints, tj, and we have to choose one clock function t per constraint. These clock functions so far can just be arbitrary phase-space functions. And using these clock functions, we can construct a new set of constraints that works as follows. First, calculate the matrix AJK, which is given by the Poisson bracket of the clock functions with the old set of constraints. Then invert this matrix and multiply it with the old set of constraints. This, and we arrive at a new set of constraints, T tilde K. And these new constraints are weakly abelian, which means that the structure functions of the algebra vanish on the constrained hypersurface. One requirement is, of course, that the clock functions have to be chosen in such a way that the matrix A is invertible in a certain region of the phase space. Using these new constraints, one can write down complete observables for field theories in the following way. Take the complete observable capital F associated to some phase space function small f and a set of clock variables tk. And this is given by the infinite sum over iterated Poisson brackets of the phase space function f with the new set of constraints t tilde times terms which are of the form tau k minus tk, where tk are the clock functions and tau k are just arbitrary parameters. One can show that this construction is formally is a Dirac observable because it commutes weakly with the constraints, and the interpretation is again a relational one. The complete observable capital F gives the value of the phase space function small f at that point on the gauge orbit where the clock functions tk have the values tau k. And on the next slide, I want to illustrate on an easy using an easy example how this works. Next slide, please. So consider a free Maxwell theory where the phase space is just given by the U1 connection A and the electric field E. And the connection A and the electric field, they form a canonically conjugate pair. In free Maxwell theory, there is a Gauss constraint, the U1 Gauss constraint, G equals the divergence of E. And according to the prescription from the last slide, we have to choose a clock function now. And it turns out to be a good choice if we choose the clock function to be the divergence of A. Using this clock function, one can compute a new set of constraints, which is just given by the Gauss constraint multiplied by the inverse of the matrix given by the Poisson bracket of T and G. And the result is the expression on the right-hand side. Using these new constraints, one can easily compute the complete observables associated to the electric field E and to the connection A. And it turns out that the complete observables are just the transversal vector modes of the theory, which is just the result what would have been expected, because the transversal vector modes are the physical modes in the theory. So it turns out that at least in free Maxwell theory, the computation with the complete observables gives the right results. And next slide, please. But the whole thing gets, of course, much more complicated in general relativity, because the gauge structure of general relativity is much more complicated than of Maxwell theory. And the complete observables for field theories are a very interesting result on the formal level. But of course, there are certain problems. First, there is this infinite sum, and it is by no means guaranteed that this infinite sum will converge throughout the whole phase space. Indeed, the convergence properties will strongly depend on the choice of clock variables. And even if the theories would converge in a certain region of the phase space, there would still be the issue of having to invert the infinite dimensional matrix AJK. Nevertheless, I think that complete observables are an ideal starting point for perturbation theory. And in the remaining part of the talk, I want to show you how one can do perturbation theory around symmetry-reduced sectors of the theory and apply the whole thing to cosmology, where the symmetry-reduced sector is just the homogeneous and isotropic function. Next slide, please.
Okay, Johannes, maybe we should take a few questions.
Sure.
Finish one part. So let me ask a question. If we look at this description that you just gave, that you just described from Bianca's, Maxwell theory, in some sense, one can choose these clock functions. I don't want to say because, but if the possibility of choosing the good clock functions is related to the possibility of doing a global gauge fixing in Maxwell.
So in general relativity,
before general relativity, there is just even in non-abelian Young-Mills theory, there are general, you know, mathematical theorems, right? That people like Singer proved long time ago. There is no global gauge fixing. There is no. So would that mean that this kind of idea about using time and so on and this relational observables not work? Or do you have some ideas as to how that might go through for non-abelian gauge theory?
So I think the answer to that question is, in general relativity, indeed finding a set of clock variables so that this sum would converge throughout the whole phase space would be equivalent to finding a perfect gauge fixing. And I think one cannot hope to find such clock variables that the series will converge throughout the whole phase space. But at least for the matter of perturbation theory, where we only look at a certain part of the phase space, at a certain closed region in the phase space, One can possibly find clock variables which have these, which work as good clocks there.
Okay, thank you very much. Carlo, can you hear now, or do you still have a problem? I guess they switched off. Okay, go ahead, Johannes.
Okay, I go ahead. So now we're on the slide, which is entitled...
I'm sorry, this is Carlo. We still hear pretty low. So if anything can be done to increase the loudness, it would be good. But we are following.
Okay. One possibility is to hold the mic closer, Johannes, and that's the only thing I can think of at this stage.
Yeah, I can try to do that.
Thank you very much. But we are following in anyway. Thanks.
Okay. So now I want to talk about how to use these relational observables and to do perturbation theory around some symmetry reduced factor of the theory. And this works as follows. First, take the phase space of the theory. This works for an arbitrary Hamiltonian theory so far. We have not specified to general relativity. Split the phase space into a symmetry reduced factor, which I call the zeroth order variables, and into anything else which are higher order variables. This can be implemented by a projection operator P that is acting on a canonical basis. And by defining that projection operator P on a canonical basis, it is clear what is the zeroth order variable and what is the first order variable, and higher order variables are then just products of first order variables. Using this split of the canonical basis in the complete observable capital F, we can sort the expression by powers of the fluctuation. So there will be a part of the complete observable which is entirely defined in the symmetry reduced sector. There will be a part which is linear in the fluctuation, a part which is quadratic, and so on. And by amputating this series after the first n plus 1 terms, that means we throw away all terms which are of more than order n in the fluctuations, we can define what we mean by a perturbative complete observable, namely such a perturbative complete observable that is just the restriction of the complete observable to the first n powers in the fluctuation. It will weakly commute with all the constraints of the theory up to terms which are of order n in the fluctuation. So that is a general prescription on how to do a perturbation theory. And on the next slide, I want to specify to the cosmological case in general relativity. Next slide, please. So take the phase space of general relativity, which is given by the FU2 connection A and the electric field E. And then there are the Gauss diffeomorphism and Hamiltonian constraints, which not only restrict the phase space, but also generate gauge transformation. And we can define a projection operator P that averages over dynamical degrees of freedom of the theory. And the projection operator is basically defined as an integral over the spatial hypersurface, sigma 3, and the trace over the tensorial variable, where I forgot to write that down, but the measure of the integral is given by the is just given by the requirement of homogeneity and isotropy. So it's just the usual Euclidean measure on the manifold. And using this projection operator P, we can split the canonical basis into two parts. We can split the connection into the projection operator acting on the connection and the identity minus the projection operator acting on the connection. And I can call the first part a zeroth order variable and the second part a first order variable. And the zeroth order variable is entirely homogeneous and isotropic. And the first order variable, the AAB, the small a, is inhomogeneous and anisotropic. One can do the same thing for the electric field. And then capital A will describe the usual Friedmann-Robertson-Walker connection, which to zeroth order just fulfills Friedmann-Robertson-Walker dynamics. And AAB is just inhomogeneous fluctuation around that. I will go more into detail later on. But first, I want to give a brief introduction into the standard theory of cosmological perturbations. Next slide, please. So the standard approach to cosmological perturbation theory works as follows. If you consider an entirely homogeneous and isotropic universe, then the most general solution you can write down is the Friedmann-Robertson-Walker solution, which for vanishing spatial curvature takes the following form. The line element df squared is given by a squared, where a is the scale factor, which describes the average distances in that universe. And then there is d eta squared, where eta is the conformal time, minus the spatial volume element dx squared. We can put the Friedmann-Robertson-Walker solution in Einstein's field equations and add matter. This will result in the Friedmann equations, which is a set of differential equations, which describes the homogeneous and the dynamics of an entirely homogeneous and isotropic universe. But the big question is, our universe is surely not homogeneous and isotropic, so how do we deal with inhomogeneity? And I will follow the approach taken by Brandenberger, Feldman, and Mukhanov here, and will outline the main thoughts of this approach. If the degree of inhomogeneity is not too huge, then it surely makes sense to do perturbation theory. We can split the four-dimensional space-time metric, g mu nu, into two parts. The Friedmann-Robertson-Walker part, which is fixed, plus perturbations around that, which is delta g mu nu. Characterize the 10 entries of delta g mu nu according to their behavior under the three-dimensional rotation group. This is what people in cosmology usually do. And one can find that there are four scalar modes. That means modes which behave as scalars to the three-dimensional rotation group. Then there are four vector modes and two tensorial modes, where the two tensor modes are just the usual gravitational waves of linearized gravity. But, for instance, from just counting the constraints of general relativity, we know that general relativity should have two independently propagating degrees of freedom. And here are these 10 modes of the perturbations delta, g, mu, nu. So the question is, what are the physical, that means gauge invariant degrees of freedom of the theory? And in pure general relativity, this question can surely not easily be answered. Otherwise, I would not have to talk about perturbation theory here. But in perturbation theory, one can try to find an answer to that question. Next slide, please. In linear order, the gauge invariant quantities can indeed be found, because one can use the fact that in linear order, the modes do not couple. That means if you insert the scalar modes, vector modes, and tensor modes into the Einstein field equations, then the resulting the dynamics of the modes will not be coupled. Furthermore, one can show that one can concentrate on the scalar modes of the gravitational perturbations for the following reason. If we add matter to the theory, then the tensorial modes will not be coupled to the matter degrees of freedom of the theory. And furthermore, one can show that in an expanding universe, the vector modes decay exponentially. So people usually focus on the scalar modes first. And in the sector of the scalar modes, the gauge invariant modes are known. Just there are these four scalar modes, and there are certain combinations of these modes which are gauge invariant. These are known as the Bardeen potentials, and these Bardeen potentials are invariant under small gauge transformations, which means, translated to a canonical language, that they commute with a linearized constraint. What people do now is they just insert these Bardeen potentials, the gauge invariant modes, plus certain matter contributions, for instance, scalar fields in the case of inflationary cosmology, into Einstein's equation and T-bone terms which are linear in the gravitational fluctuations and the matter fluctuations. This will result in a system of differential equations which describes the dynamical evolution of matter and gravitational perturbations on a fixed Friedmann-Robertson-Walker background to linear order. And it turns out that linear perturbation theory is the most important tool to study physics of the early universe for the following reason. Take your preferred theory of the very early universe and just calculate what kind of predictions it makes for the distribution of inhomogeneities a short time after the Big Bang, and then use the theory of linear perturbations, evolve the density distribution, for instance, until 300,000 years after the Big Bang, and then one can directly test these theories and compare them to the cosmological microwave spectrum. Now, linear perturbation theory is a very important tool in cosmology, and it is very well established. But there are certain problems when one tries to generalize this linear theory to higher orders. Next slide, please. And these problems are, for instance, the following. First, the modes couple in higher orders. That means it is problematic to extract gauge-invariant observables already to second order. It is difficult to distinguish physical perturbations from mere coordinate artifacts. That means if analog quantities to the Bardeen potentials are not known, then one cannot compute physical dynamics. That means we cannot trust the dynamical evolution in the sense that if we start with a certain density distribution and we evolve it according to the laws of the theory, if we do not have gauge-invariant quantities as the Bardeen potentials, then we can never know in the end if what we see in the equations is not just perturbations into gauge direction. One other problem is that there are back reaction effects. That means the split into background and perturbations gets ambiguous in higher order, because the dynamics of the background, that means the Friedmann-Robson-Walker dynamics, gets influenced by perturbations starting at second order. In a sense, Friedmann-Robson-Walker is only a zeroth order approximation to the true dynamical behavior of homogeneous and isotropic quantities. And the full theory, of course, will have corrections to that behavior. A third point is that if you look into the papers of higher order cosmological perturbation theory, the calculations are very messy. And I think that using the relational approach, one has a chance to overcome some of these problems to a certain extent. Are there questions so far? Okay, then next slide, please. Now I want to talk about how to use the relational framework of observables and how to apply this to cosmological perturbation theory. First, I want to outline the main thoughts of this approach, and then I want to go into the details. So first, this approach is based on relational observables of full general relativity, which means that we start with the complete observables in the expression written down by Bianca Dietrich, and although these observables are only known at a very formal level, we try to approximate these observables around certain symmetry-reduced sectors of the theory, and in the cosmological case, this symmetry-reduced sector is given by the homogeneous and isotropic functions. And contrary to the standard approach, where one fixes Friedmann-Robertson-Walker first, then puts certain perturbations on there and then tries to find gauge-invariant combinations of these perturbations, we go quite the other way around, because we start from full general relativity and approximate the observables of full general relativity around Friedmann-Robertson-Walker. Because we do not fix a background metric in the beginning, we do not have fixed coordinates on the manifold, or at least not physically meaningful coordinates. So the coordinates are not put in by hand, but are defined in a purely dynamical way. So in a sense, we use critical fields to define what space and time are. For instance, one could use scalar fields and define points in space-time by the values that certain scalar fields have at that point. Furthermore, because there is no fixed background, one still can talk about the background in the theory if one just identifies the background with the symmetry-reduced sector of homogeneous and isotropic fields. But this background emerges through an averaging procedure of dynamical degrees of freedom on the spatial hypersurface. And therefore, just because a background emerges through averaging over dynamical degrees of freedom, it stays entirely dynamical, which means that the symplectic structure in the background is non-vanishing, which turns out to be very important for consistency in higher-order perturbation theory, as you will see later on when I show you how one can calculate back reaction effects using this approach. Furthermore, the calculations are still hard to do in this approach, But at least because there is something Feynman-like interpretation in terms of free propagation and interactions, it is easy to write down which terms would have to be calculated if you are interested in perturbations in a certain order. Well, the free propagation is the linear evolution of perturbations on Friedman-Robertson-Walker background, or the Friedman-Robertson-Walker evolution of homogeneous and isotropic quantities. And the interactions are couplings between these different modes. For instance, couplings between homogeneous quantities and inhomogeneous quantities. Next slide, please. Now I want to go into the details a little bit more. And we start with a phase space of general relativity, which is given by the SU2 connection in Ashtikov's variables and the conjugate momentum E. They form a canonically conjugate pair. It is not necessary to use Ashtikov's variables. The same thing would hold in the metric formalism, but we have done the calculations for using Ashtikov's variables in the articles, so I want to present it that way here. Furthermore, there's a Gauss constraint, the diffeomorphism constraint, and the Hamiltonian constraint, and throughout this talk I will use the wave 2 version of the Hamiltonian constraint. We don't leave the area of classical general relativity here, so it doesn't really matter. Now we define, as I told you, the projection operator onto the homogeneous and isotropic subspace, which is given by the integral over the spatial hypersurfaces and the trace over the variables. And now we can split the canonical basis into two parts, split the connection into a zeroth order part and a first order part, and the conjugate momentum E into a zeroth order part and a first order part, where the zeroth order part is given by the projection operator acting on the variables, and the first order part is the identity minus the projection operator acting on the variables. The zeroth order variables are entirely homogeneous and isotropic, and these capital A and capital E are the usual variables of Friedman-Robertson-Walker cosmology. The symplectic structure of these variables is given by the formula on the right side, and it is important that the symplectic structure in the background sector does not vanish. As you will see later on, this is very important for consistency in higher order perturbation theory, and the symplectic structure in the fluctuation sector is a little bit degenerate, but we can deal with that. Next slide, please. So some technical details. Throughout the calculations, we assumed that the spatial topology of the of sigma 3 is compact. We assumed that there is a torus topology. Furthermore, we worked in Fourier space and have chosen to work with a fixed value for the immersive parameter in order to simplify the Hamiltonian constraint. And these are all, these assumptions are all not mandatory for the framework, but they simplify the calculations a little bit, so we work with these assumptions. The constraints for general relativity, I've written down the parts in blue, which would have to be added if there is a minimally coupled scalar field. And the constraints for general relativity are just functions of the canonical variables E and A. And using the split of the basis into zeroth order part and the first order part, one can just insert the split of the basis into the constraint and then sort the constraints by powers of fluctuation. And the result is the following. Next slide, please. The perturbative structure of the constraint is the following. If you perform a Fourier decomposition of the result, then the k equals zero modes are just the integrated constraints, basically the constraints integrated all over the spatial manifold, and the k unequals zero modes. Is everybody there?
Yes.
Okay. Then I go on. And the k unequals zero modes are the rest. The k unequals zero modes of the constraints, they all start at first order in the fluctuations. And the Gauss constraints for k equals zero start at first order as well. But there are certain special things, because the diffeomorphism constraint for k equals 0, that is the diffeomorphism constraint just integrated all over the spatial hypersurface, starts at quadratic order in the fluctuation, and the Hamiltonian constraint has a zeroth order part, has a vanishing first order part, and has a second order part, and so on. First, to the Hamiltonian constraint, it is essential for this perturbation scheme that the first order contribution to the integrated Hamiltonian constraint vanishes. And furthermore, the zeroth order part of the integrated Hamiltonian constraint is just the usual Friedmann-Robertson-Walker Hamiltonian constraint. So if you just take this part of the Hamiltonian constraint, then this will result in usual Friedmann-Robertson-Walker dynamics. But as you can already guess here, this is not the whole part of the story. But the second problem is that the integrated diffeomorphism constraints for A equals 0 start at second order, which is related to the assumption that we have chosen to work on a manifold with compact spatial topology. This goes under the name linearization instabilities in the literature and has to do with the fact that there is an extra translational invariance due to the torus compactification. This is a problem for the perturbative approach because, as I told you, in the formula for the complete observables, there is one essential part. You have to calculate a matrix between the clock variables and the constraints. And if one of the constraints starts at second order, then it is not possible to perturbatively invert these matrix. But there are still two possibilities how to deal with these linearization instabilities. The first one is we can use massless scalar fields as clocks and choose the massless scalar fields in such a way that they break the translation invariance on the torus, on the three torus, and so the diffeomorphism constraint will get the first order part and the linearization instabilities can be solved. Or, as we have shown in one of the articles, it is consistent to first calculate complete observables with respect to all the other constraints and deal with the linearization instabilities after solving for the remaining constraints. Other questions so far?
Yes. On a previous transparency, you sort of told us that you are looking at the torus and... but this is just for simplification, you could do something else. But it seems to me that if you are going to look at the open universe in the k equals 0 case, then there really is a tension. And I wonder if you have already thought about this or you are just postponing. Namely, in the full phase space, you have to tell us, one has to tell what the full phase space is. Now, in the non-compact case, one typically uses asymptotically flat or asymptotically antidistorted or some such boundary conditions, which are clearly incompatible with the boundary conditions of spatial homogeneity and isotropy. And therefore, this kind of embedding of the homogeneous isotropic sector in a full phase space, the kind of the division that you did between the Poinsot brackets, is not really possible. And one might say, well, we just introduce a particular cell. Then for the homogeneous mode, you can use a cell. But for the inhomogeneous mode, then the cell causes all kinds of problems. So, it's perfectly fine to use torus as a starting point. But I'm just wondering if you have also thought about the more general and more difficult.
In the case of cosmology, we have so far only considered the torus topology for the spatial hypersurfaces. But in the other paper where we have considered perturbations around Friedmann-Robertson-Walker, there we have considered, of course, an open universe. And it is possible to deal with the boundary conditions there as well. But I must say that in the cosmological case so far, I have not thought about that.
Okay. And the second question was that you had given two alternatives to linearization instabilities. The first is to use massless scalar field as clocks. Can this actually be done? I mean, is this a full massless scalar field that you're using as a clock or only the homogeneous mode? And
I want to tell a little bit about that on the next slide. But it turned actually out that in the analysis that massless scalar fields are not a preferred choice if you do cosmology, because it is very hard to compare these results to the results obtained in the usual approach to cosmological perturbation theory. Maybe I go on. Next slide, please. So, concerning the clock variables, of course, there are many different possible choices for clock variables, because they just have to be phase-based functions chosen in a certain way. And one choice might be to choose four scalar fields as clocks. And so you just introduce four exoscalar fields to the theory, the scalar field phi 0 and three scalar fields phi a, where a runs from 1 to 3. And one can actually try to build clock functions out of these scalar fields by just using them as clock functions for associated to the diffeomorphism constraint and associated to the Hamiltonian constraint. And then one builds a clock function associated to the Gauss constraints out of gravitational modes. And I don't want to say too much about these clock functions, but the big problem, the advantage of these clock functions is, of course, that there are no linearization instabilities, because the translational invariance of the background is broken in the case that the massless scalar fields phi a are chosen such that the average over the part which depends on sigma does not vanish on average. And but it's very hard to compare these things with a standard approach to cosmological perturbation theory for the following reason. Whenever there are scalar fields in the theory, then these scalar fields have to do with a certain localized energy density, and this is quite in contrast to the usual definition of a global coordinate system in Friedman-Roberts-Walker universes. So at least so far, I do not see how one could compare the results using these clocks with the Friedman-Roberts-Walker case. Another possibility is to choose gravitational motive clocks. Next slide, please. And one can try to build clocks out of gravitational modes. There are many different choices possible. And if one wants to get as close to the Friedman-Roberts-Walker coordinate system as possible, then it turns out that it's most convenient to choose non-local functions containing certain tensorial modes of the inhomogeneous anisotropic parts of the gravitational fields, where by non-local I mean that these functions include inverse powers of the Laplace operator, which is basically an integral all over the space and hypersurface. And I want to show you one set of clock variables we have chosen for the computation. We call them longitudinal clocks for a reason which will become obvious on the next slide. And this is just certain combinations of tensorial modes of the gravitational field. And using these longitudinal clocks, one can get very close to the standard treatment, because they don't have a straightforward local interpretation, but one can say that in the gauge where these clocks are set to zero, one is as close as possible to the Friedman-Roberts-Walker coordinate system, to the fixed Friedman-Roberts-Walker coordinate system. And if one goes away from this gauge, then the metric will more or less be deformed. The big problem using these clocks, which appears in higher order perturbation theory, is that because they include these inverse Laplace operators, the observables will include non-local terms in higher order as well. And this is a problem for the interpretation of these observables.
Is the inverse Laplacian taken with respect to the full physical metric? Or is it taken with the homogeneous part of the physical metric?
No, it's taken with respect to the homogeneous part.
Okay, so then it is not that bad in the sense that to any order in the perturbation theory, you could just go to the momentum space in this spatially flat case, and then this Laplacian to the minus 1 are just momentum space integrals.
Yeah, but I think it's mainly a problem for the interpretation of the observables in for the higher order observables. If there are non-local terms in there, then one has to think about that. Sure. Next slide, please. So now I want to tell you how one can, in principle, regain linear perturbation theory. And this works as follows. Take a first order quantity f, which can, for instance, be the scalar, a scalar, a vector, or a tensor mode of the linearized gravitational field, or just some tensor modes of the fluctuations, and calculate the first order approximation to the complete observable for such a quantity. And that means we throw away all terms which are more than linear in fluctuation in the complete observable. And using the longitudinal clocks from the last slide, we can reproduce the standard result of linear cosmological perturbation theory, but in a purely relational way. I call these clocks the longitudinal clocks because one can reproduce these results, which are usually obtained in the longitudinal gauge, which means basically cutting the shift vector to zero. And what one gains there is one can write down a system of differential equations for the first order approximations to the complete observables. And this system of differential equations can be shown to be equivalent to the one from the standard approach, with all the advantages and disadvantages. So one could think about defining generalized propagator functions on curved backgrounds, etc. But at least one gets the usual results of first-order perturbation theory. But the main scope of this formalism is surely not that one can recast first-order perturbation theory. What is much more important is that in principle, this formalism holds as well in higher orders. Perturbation theory, because we can just consider higher order approximations to these complete observables. And on the next slide, I want to show you how this works, at least for one example, that this formalism is well suited to ask the question of back reaction effects. That is, consider a complete observable for a zeroth order quantity f. The zeroth order quantity is an entirely homogeneous and isotropic quantity, which could, for instance, be the scale factor or the total spatial volume, or in terms of Astikas variables, the homogeneous E or the homogeneous connection A. If we consider zeroth order approximation to such a complete observable F, then one can see that this coincides with the usual Friedman-Robertson-Walker dynamics for homogeneous and isotropic quantities, F. But because this is only the zeroth order approximation to the complete observable, one can already see that this is not the full story. There will be higher order corrections. And the first order contribution to that observable vanishes due to consistency requirements. And but one can calculate the second-order approximation to the complete observable for homogeneous and isotropic quantities f, and one sees that this quantity is indeed the quadratic in the fluctuation span. So the second-order approximation to the complete observable f is given by the free evolution, which is just the usual Friedman-Robertson-Walker part of f, plus certain extra terms, and these extra terms are all quadratic in the fluctuation. And I want to explain it as follows. The second line in the formula on the right-hand side, inside the Poisson bracket, there is this alpha free of f, which is the usual Friedman-Robertson-Walker dynamics of a homogeneous quantity f. And this this is entirely homogeneous and isotropic. And but there is a Poisson bracket with a certain second-order part of the constraint t tilde. And these constraints, C tilde, will be quadratic in the fluctuations, but includes homogeneous and isotropic variables as well. That means the constraint C tilde, the second order approximation, is a product of homogeneous variables and of two first order variables. And here comes the essential part that the symplectic structure in the background sector does not vanish. So the whole Poisson bracket will not vanish as well and will be quadratic in the fluctuation. These, the product of the whole Poisson bracket is a product of homogeneous variables and first-order variables and gets freely propagated again. There will be more terms which I have not written down, which are basically the gauge invariant extension of these terms. The constraint, the 2C tilde, depends, of course, very much on the choice of clock variables, tk, And for a general model with inhomogeneities, we have not explicitly calculated the back reaction effects yet, but in principle, it should be possible to use these formula for certain choices for clock variables and then just calculate the back reaction effect. But what we have done so far is just to illustrate how the computation of back reaction effects works using a simple model, namely the Bianchi 1 model. Next slide, please. And the Bianchi 1 model is a homogeneous but anisotropic cosmological model, which has the advantage that it can be exactly solved. So we can just compare the exact solution to the zeroth order approximation and second order approximation, and it does not have inhomogeneities, so one can get around all the problems which occur for inhomogeneity. The setup is the following. There is the F given by the diagonal matrix A1, 3, and the conjugate momentum E is just a diagonal matrix E1, E2, E3. Further in the model, there is a homogeneous scalar field with momentum pi, and the Hamiltonian constraint takes the form written down there for free massive scalar fields. And what we can do now is to treat the Bianchi 1 model as perturbations around Friedmann, Robertson, Walker. That means anisotropic perturbations around the isotropic sector. By defining the average capital A as the average over all the AIs and capital E as the average over all the EIs, and defining small AI as the anisotropic perturbation around this mean value, the same for E. And now we can consider complete observables which are associated to capital E and to the choice of clock variable E equals phi over pi. That means we are looking for the dynamical evolution of the homogeneous and isotropic quantity E with respect to time, which is measured in terms of scalar field phi over its momentum pi. And if you prefer to think in metric variables, then E is related to the scale factor, as I think E should be the scale factor squared. So giving the observables for E makes predictions for the global dynamics of the homogeneous model. Next slide, please. So the observables are the following. We can consider the exact solution. I told you that the model is exactly solvable, and the complete observable associated to E and the clock frame function T given by phi over pi. It's just some sum over exponential functions. We can use the approach, the perturbative approach based on relational observables to compute the zeroth order approximation and the second order approximation just using the formulas from the second last slide. The zeroth order approximation is just the usual Friedmann-Robertson-Walker term, and it's just basically E times the exponential function. The second order approximation is the zeroth order approximation plus terms which are quadratic in the anisotropies. I denoted the anisotropies in green color here, and as you see there is this zeroth order part E, and all the other parts are quadratic in the fluctuations. Next slide, please. If we plot all these functions, the plot is the complete observable F associated to E and T, and that means we are looking for the dynamics of E with respect to time, which is measured in units of phi over pi. The red one is the exact solution, the blue one is the zeroth order approximation, and the green one is the second order approximation, written down for the initial conditions on the bottom of the page. And one can already see that the zeroth order approximation is not a too good approximation to the true physical behavior of homogeneous quantities for all times. And the second order approximation, including back reaction effects, which fits much better. Next slide, please. What did we learn from considering the Bianchi 1 model just as a toy model? First, I think that It shows that the calculation of battery action effects using relational observables is straightforward. Of course, in the Bianchi 1 model, the computations are not hard to do because there are no inhomogeneities there. But at least in principle, it should be possible to calculate battery action effects using complete observables in a physically more realistic model as well. Furthermore, it shows that Friedman-Robertson-Walker is not a good approximation to the true dynamical behavior of homogeneous and isotropic quantities for all times, at least not for all initial conditions. And we can be sure that battery action effects are physical effects because we worked on a gauge invariant level all the time. And so the battery action effects are not mere coordinate artifacts. Of course, the model is too simple to draw any conclusions for the real universe in the sense that we cannot predict anything like how would the how much would be the degree of inhomogeneities or back reactions in the real universe. But it would be very interesting to use the method of relational observables to calculate back reactions in a physically more realistic model, and maybe to say something about the question for which range of initial conditions does perturbation theory make sense there? Next slide. So I want to conclude what I have told you in the talk. I think that relational observables are well suited to describe the dynamics in general relativity because they take the fact of background independence of general relativity very seriously. Of course, one can apply the framework of relational observables to cosmology, but I even think that applying these relational frameworks to cosmology has several advantages compared to the standard approach, mainly due to the reason that, contrary to the usual approach where one starts with a fixed Friedman-Robertson-Walker background, then puts certain perturbations on there, and tries to find gauge invariance combinations, we just go the other way around. We start from full of observables of full general relativity. And although these observables are not known exactly, they are only known at a formal level, we try to approximate these observables around the homogeneous and isotropic sector of Friedman-Robertson-Walker cosmology. What is very interesting is that there is only one scheme for arbitrary orders. That means we just have to amputate the series in the complete observables after a certain part, after a certain power in the fluctuation. And furthermore, it has a very nice interpretation because the background, or if you define the background to be the symmetry reduced sector of the theory, then the background is not put in by hand, but the background emerges through averaging procedure over dynamical degrees of freedom and stays dynamical all the time. Furthermore, I think that this is an ideal framework to calculate background action effects in cosmology. And maybe one could shed some new light on the question if battery action effects possibly have something to say about the dark energy problem, in the sense that if Friedman-Robertson-Walker is only a zeroth-order approximation to the true dynamical behavior of homogeneous quantities, then maybe the battery action effects are so huge that they could substantially alter the dynamics of our universe. And this is sometimes discussed in the literature, and maybe the method of relational observables could shed some new light on this question. That's it. Thanks.
Questions?
Yes, this is John Engel. I could ask a question. In the particular case that you investigated, Bianchi 1 as a perturbation around FRW, it seemed that the perturbation series, giving the complete observable, did seem to converge. But is there some general argument that would suggest that one expects it to converge generally?
I think in principle there is no argument that the theory should converge. Because the equations are quite nonlinear, and so at least in principle it could be that that higher order contributions substantially alter the dynamics. But Yeah, I'm not really sure about that.
Okay, thank you.
So I had a follow-up to Abhay's question for the case of the open universe. So the issue there, is it correct that I understand that what's going on is that when you take the zeroth order integral, it blows up?
Right, if you integrate on the whole...
So can't one just like take a box and then
right.
take limits,
right.
basically?
Right, so one could take a box, but then for the zeroth order for quantities, everything is okay. But for the first order quantities, okay, let me say why it is okay for the zeroth order quantities. It is because when you do integrations and such things from the action, from symplectic structure conservation and such things, one sees in the homogeneous case that the contribution from one side of the box is the same as that of the other side of the box, so it all cancels out. But in the inhomogeneous, for the little A and little E modes, which are not homogeneous, the symplectic structure would not be conserved if you just take an arbitrary box. If you take a limit, maybe one can do something, but it's going to be tricky because somehow you want to make sure that the homogeneous mode, so to say, perfectly okay, but that is to say the homogeneous mode remains homogeneous, but the inhomogeneous modes die off at a suitable rate. Something like that could be done, but it's never been done, to my knowledge.
Yeah, okay, that sounds reasonable.
I have two basic questions, to be honest. And these really are questions about comparison. I mean, you said a couple of times that your general framework in the cosmological context, not necessarily Bianchi 1, the general framework in the cosmological context does reduce to the standard one. So by that, I presumably you mean that for every gauge invariant quantity that Mukhanov and Baradin write down, you can write down a corresponding relational Dirac observer, and their evolution to the first order is the same as that given in the standard theory. Is that what
yeah.
you mean?
Yeah, that's what I mean. So we have considered the complete observable approximation, first order approximation for the scalar modes and for the tensor modes, and one can show that if, of course, the complete observables have more than first order terms, but if one only looks at the first order terms, then one can show that these first order approximations lead to differential equations which are the same as in the standard case.
Okay. But you said that in the higher order, higher to higher orders, there are some problems that other people have, but you only mentioned that it is just very complicated. But so they might come back and argue that your scheme is also complicated because of all the non-localities and so on. In what sense is this scheme simpler at higher order than what other people do in the literature?
So I think one essential point is that people who do standard cosmological perturbation theory, in every order you have to find the gauge invariant quantities, and it is somehow complicated to define what do you mean by gauge invariant quantities to a certain order. For instance, in the linear order it's easy because the linearized constraints, they throw in algebra, but in higher order it is sometimes more complicated. And this approach has the advantage that you can easily define what you mean by gauge invariant, and you can just amputate the series after a certain power of the fluctuations. And in this sense, one can it has somehow an advantage compared to the standard approach.
Yeah,
but of course there are certain the problem in this approach mainly lies in the choice of clock variables. That is the big problem here.
Right. So you want to say that at least conceptually there is a framework which is very systematic, whereas there is no such framework in the usual way of doing things.
Yeah, right. The big advantage is that there is one framework which works for all orders, You don't have to look for gauge invariant quantities order by order, but you can just start with an arbitrary phase-based function, insert this into the complete observable, and then just amputate the complete observable at some point, and this will be a gauge invariant expression to a certain order, and it is defined what gauge invariant means in this sense.
Well, the second question is really, again, comparison to the literature. Martin Boyerwald, who unfortunately is not in the room here, I don't know if he's listening from somewhere, and various other people who are in the room, I think, yes, Mikhail Kagan and Ghulam Hossein and others, have also done perturbation theory. I mean, their interest is to see some quantum corrections, but the first step in the program is to do this perturbation theory. And they also use connection variables. So it will be nice to know what the relation is, what the similarities are, and what the differences are. Can you or anybody else enlighten us on this?
I think what one can say is that, as far as I know, they work on a gauge stick level to a certain extent. And what is interesting is that one can use the approach of complete observables and try to find out which clock variables somehow give certain gauge fixings back. So in this sense, as I told you, one can find the set of longitudinal clocks, and using these results, you're doing the computations using the longitudinal clocks, one can compare the results to the longitudinal gauge, and I think one would have to go more into that direction if one wants to use these things for gauge fixing itself.
Okay, so if I understand it, what you're saying is that what Martin and collaborators are doing is really in connection variables very similar to what Bukhanov, etc. do in metric variables. And therefore, and they're also going on into first order, and therefore whatever remarks you made earlier about relation to the standard first-order perturbation theory hold also for comparison between what you are doing and what Boyerwald et al. Are doing. Is that fair, or am I misunderstanding what you said?
No, I think I wanted to say that what Martin and collaborators are doing is, as far as I know, they have taken the covariant results and just formulated a perturbation theory in the Hamiltonian language. But I think the main scope of our work was just to use relational observables to
right.
Do the
that's
thing.
Exactly what I was saying. Okay, good.
Okay.
And now for the last question is about this Bianchi 1 model. In the full theory, you define your homogeneous variables by integration. Of course, in the Bianchi 1 model, you can't quite do that because everything is homogeneous to begin with. But there will be several different ways of trying to define kind of the mean variables, and adding taking the average of A1, A2, A3, and E1, E2, E3 is one of those ways. For example, if one had used kind of Misner kind of variables, one might have done something somewhat different as to how to extract the homogeneous part the isotropic part from the anisotropic one. So my question is, if you go along your way, that is to say, just take the algebraic average of A1, A2, A3, and same similarly E1, E2, E3, what is special about this? Is it the case that when you do this, then the equations that the average quantity satisfy are the standard Friedman equations?
That's right.
Okay, so that is the case, and that is why one gets...
Yeah, that is why we have chosen to average in that way. One can easily show that the zeroth order approximation for the zeroth order approximation for capital A and capital E is just the usual Friedman Robertson Walker dynamics.
Okay, so these are all my questions. Thank you. Other people, please ask questions. A comment?
I have one more question. This is John again. Johannes, you in your averaging procedure for projecting onto the homogeneous isotropic variables, you integrate, but you integrate with respect to a particular measure, with respect to a particular volume form, because it's I mean, you're not always going to be integrating weight one quantities. I was a little confused about that.
Yeah. The big problem in the construction of this projection operator in this form is that it's, of course, not diffeomorphically invariant in that way, because you basically use the background metric to construct this this projection operator. In as far as one is only interested in classical perturbation theory, which is not too far away from Friedmann-Walker, one can construct this operator in that way. But it would surely be interesting if there's any possibility to promote this operator into a more diffeomorphism invariant object, to see if one can make use of this operator in quantum theory.
Thank you.
It's not just a matter of volume element, right? I mean, one has this habit of writing delta AI and thinking that delta AI is a sort of not any extra structure. But in fact, delta, there is no natural isomorphism between the internal space and the tangent space. And delta AIs really are some background triad, E0 AI.
Right.
And all these projections are defined with respect to this background triad, and the volume element
right. Is
that background triad. And so you're saying that, well, if somebody else chose some other background triad, what would happen, everything would transform and so on, is not entirely clear. Is that what you're saying?
That's right.
I think it's not difficult either to work out, in a cosmological context, work out the transformation theory. You can make it reasonably invariant. I mean, one should do the work, but I'm pretty sure that this can all be taken care of.
Any other questions? Okay, before we thank the speaker then, the next talk is 2 weeks from now, and we still have the slot open on October the 2nd, so if you want to speak, please let me know. So let's thank Johannes again.
Also, just one more thing.
Yeah.
That next time also the seminar is at the same time as today, right? 15 minutes after the canonical time, so to speak.
Okay, let's thank Johannes again.